and we'll be talking about the web of meaning.
If you're not mentally as well, this energy you're sending me is tricky as hell. Usually it's like a 50-50, we could take a L before we start things. At this point, being apart brings the feeling of somebody plucking at your heartstrings. I know it probably shouldn't feel like this, but any other woman I see is in your likeness. It's from your cheekbones, to your lips, to your curves, to your deep moans, to that walk, to your words. Your love feeling like a breakdown on the verge. First we on good terms, then you on my last nerves. Got my back just aching, my shoes is all tight. It's too complex when we choose to do it right. It's wrong. One minute you a soldier strong, then you trying to route, talking about it's over and gone.
I've been wondering about the complexity of what we have here. Should there be more? Just can't see more. I've been wondering about the complexity of what we have here. Should there be more? Just can't see more.
Yeah. When your boyfriend's in town, it's bound to be trouble, love. His name Black and he known to be a lover of. Getting it on with my smoker jacket on. Eyes racing back and forth, listening to Shaka Khan. Trying to figure the cause why you always acting off like I'm slacking off.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, technological.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Certified Farmers Markets, featuring three markets in Butte County. Year-round markets in Chico at the North Valley Plaza on Wednesday morning and at 3rd and Wall in downtown Chico on Saturday morning. There's also a seasonal market in Paradise on Tuesday morning. The Chico Certified Farmers Market, connecting farmers and food lovers since 1980.
The opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily express the views of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, volunteers, underwriters, or programmers. We'll be back shortly to talk with Jeremy Lent about The Web of Meaning. It's a new book about language, culture, and our place in the universe.
If language were liquid, it would be rushing in. Instead, here we are in a silence more eloquent than any word could ever be. These words are too solid. Move fast enough. To catch the blur in the brain that flies by and is gone, and is gone, and is gone, 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 and is gone. Less place, somewhere out of context and beyond all consequences. Let's go back to the birds and a little less. 12 is not far away, and the river is there, and the sun and the space are all laying there, and we'll sit in the silence that comes rushing in and is gone. Is gone.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and we are pleased to welcome Jeremy Lent to the program. Jeremy was born in London and has educational roots at Cambridge University and the University of Chicago. He lives in Berkeley and is the founder of the Leology Institute, about which we'll ask him later in the program.
A couple of years ago, we interviewed Jeremy about his excellent book, The Patterning Instinct, and listeners may recall that we replayed that interview just last month. Jeremy has a new book from New Society Publishers. It's called The Web of Meaning, Integrating Science and Traditional Wisdom to Find Our Place in the Universe. Welcome, Jeremy Lent.
Well, thank you so much, Stephen and Susan. I'm very happy to be back on the show with you both.
Likewise. We enjoyed The Web of Meaning as much as we enjoyed The Patterning Instinct. And in fact, the title and subtitle of your book kind of give us fodder for the entire interview. And let me just read it again. The Web of Meaning, Integrating Science and Traditional Wisdom to Find Our Place in the Universe. Maybe we could just touch on those elements briefly before we get into more detail. Specifically, what do you mean by the Web of Meaning?
Yeah, well, sure. So it's referring to really that complex network of connectedness that each of us is really embedded in our entire existence. And what the book sort of explores is that it's through recognizing and embracing that connectedness itself that meaning actually arises in our lives.
And science, broadly bandied about word these days, what are you thinking of when you talk about science in the subtitle?
Right, sure. When I say integrating science and traditional wisdom, yeah. Well, that's a lot of the book really goes deeply into science. And one of the major themes of the book is that a lot of what we take for a quote-unquote science in our mainstream way of thinking is actually not very scientific at all. It's actually been superseded by findings in science in recent decades. And so that's actually a really key part of the book. So really, when I look at science, I'm really, if I'm to give a definition of science, it's more than anything, it's a methodology. It's actually a methodology that has values attached to it, values like transparency and openness to empirical evidence and a willingness to always be investigating and try to understand our cosmos in a greater and greater way. So I see science as a methodology, but in the book I unpack the way in which most of the time when we think of science, it's actually a particular type of science known as reductionism that people actually think they're talking about.
Right. And you'll offer some alternatives to reductionist science. And then traditional wisdom. What are your principal sources for traditional wisdom?
Well, it's quite widespread, really. Yes. And I look a lot of different sources of indigenous knowledge from around the world, whether it's Native American wisdom here in North America or Aboriginal understandings from Australia and other places. I also look at some of the non-Western traditions that have been huge parts of the sort of human heritage. So Buddhism from Southeast Asia, Taoism, from ancient China, and then there's a particular type of incredible wisdom that I, in my research over the years, I sort of came across that very few people know about. Most people are somewhat aware if they're looking at alternative ways of understanding things. They're somewhat aware of, you know, Taoism, and of course, many people are quite into Buddhism. Mm-hmm. But there's this source of wisdom called Neo-Confucianism from about 1,000 years ago in traditional China that actually integrated or synthesized some of the most, the deepest ideas from Taoism, Confucianism, and Buddhism into a kind of a comprehensive way of understanding the universe. And I refer to that again and again through the book because I find it to be one of the most valuable sources of understanding how we relate to the cosmos. That what I find so fascinating about it is that it relates so strongly to modern findings in systems thinking and in systems sciences.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, and then finally, you talk a little bit about finding our place in the universe. And I think we probably have the arrogance to think we already know what that is. But we thought we'd ask you to deal with our current culture as our place in the universe. The web of meaning at the moment is vitriolic. We have extreme hatred, xenophobia, anger, violence, denial of science by some people. There's what most of us would call irrationality. There's fake news that becomes real news, and so on. How does your book explain the origins of this kind of tangled web?
Yeah, well, there's multi layers to it, and as you say, we could take a whole interview just looking at all at the different layers of origins. But I think to come to the essential part of what the book looks at a lot is this: what we take for granted, which I call our worldview, the way we make sense of things and think this is how life works and how the universe works, and then our values arise implicitly from that. A lot of that worldview in the modern mainstream is based on separation. It's based on a sense that humans are separate from the rest of nature. In fact, nature is just a machine, like, or a resource to exploit. It's based on the sense that each of us as humans are individuals, utterly separate from others. And that's and it's really like just looking out for the individual is what we're meant to be doing with our lives. And it's this sense of separation, we're told, is actually scientific. We're told, oh, well, the selfish gene, nature itself is selfish, and humans are actually the most, we sort of evolved to be competitive, and being selfish is actually good for everybody. And it's only, in fact, if you look, we're told scientifically in sort of quasi-science that if the history of humans is that we were all fighting against each other before civilization came along and told us to be more moral. And all of these things turn out to be just actually scientifically false. So in terms of how we got to this place, a lot of it has to do with the sense that this belief in separation. And rather than really us living right now in a web of meaning, I think many people are so unclosed to those connections between things that we actually live more than anything in sort of little islands of meaninglessness rather than a web of meaning. So a lot of what I'm offering in the book is a pathway for us to kind of open up to actually recognize and embrace our connectedness.
I want to follow up a little bit about the current mess. Can we blame Donald Trump? I mean, we've seen a blossoming of this anger and hatred. Has it been there all along? And you do take some good whacks at the selfish gene concept in your book. So we can assume that many of the traits that we're seeing surface have been around for a while. And I'm not advocating for the selfish gene. I want to ask you if there's an altruistic gene to match it. But What catalyzed the current?
I certainly don't think we can blame Trump for all the bad things that we have been experiencing. Certainly, just like any populist and sort of fascist-oriented authoritarian, he definitely whips up and exacerbates negative traits that are there already. I think if we want to go looking at some of the sources of where what Trump is able to take advantage of, I think it comes a lot from the domination in the last few decades of the sort of neoliberal ideology that has really taken over our country and that has led to this incredible rise in inequality, and that's led to a real sense of desolation, emotional, spiritual, economic desolation among so many people in this country. And I think that the those who have taken advantage of this this neoliberal ideology then use their control of the media and their control of the political platforms to turn people's attention away from the true cause of their sense of desolation, which is basically the elites sucking up wealth from the country at the expense of everybody else. But they turn their attention to false senses of, blaming the other, which is just a classic strategy of fascism and populism that we saw all the way back in the 1930s. And it's not that surprising that we see it again right now. So if we go sort of peel the onion like one layer deep, and that's where I think we have to look much more carefully at that. But then to go to the much deeper layers of the question that you asked, the sort of multifaceted question, well, do we have these intrinsic selfish genes or altruistic genes, or what is it that makes human nature? Well, first off, the very notion that there is a gene for something, whether it's the selfishness or altruism, has been shown by modern research in biology to be absolutely false, and that genes do and are sometimes necessary for certain aspects of who we are as people, but it's much more about how the gene is manifested, how it's expressed, and the interaction between the gene and the cell and the environment and the organism. It's those complex feedback loops that actually cause us to become who we are. And so then if we actually say, well, who are we? Are we inherently selfish? Are we inherently altruistic? What I think we are is, as humans, as I described in that first book, The Patterning Instinct, that's one of the things that defines humans, is that we are very culturally plastic, if you will. We have a patterning instinct. And from infancy, whatever our culture tells us it brings out to make sense of the world, those are the elements that get amplified in our makeup. So if our culture tells us that actually being part of a group is fundamentally important, such as indigenous cultures, and that we're connected deeply with Mother Nature around us, we'll grow up believing that and acting in that way. If our culture tells us we're all selfish, and selfishness is what actually makes the world work, and it's a dog-eat-dog world out there, and so the best thing you can do is just, try to out-compete others and have as much status as possible, if that's what we're told by our culture from a young age onwards, then of course those attributes are going to be far more amplified in who we become as people. So I think that's key. But then, if we want to say, well, what is it then that makes us humans in terms of, is there a human nature? I think there is. If you look back at pre-human history, we spent basically 95% of the human species history as nomadic hunter-gatherers. And even before then, for millions of years, if you look at how we actually diverged from other primates, maybe 6 to 8 million years ago or so, what we find is that what actually distinguishes us from other primates, such as orangutans or gorillas or chimpanzees, is that we are far more cooperative. Humans our ancestors evolved in the savannah in dangerous environments to discover that actually by working together in groups, we got to be more successful. And we actually evolved moral emotions, as they're called. So feelings like compassion, altruism, a love of generosity. We love people who we feel are generous. And a sense of when we see something done that's unfair, we actually get enraged emotionally. We want to get, and we'll even, at risk to ourselves or sacrifice to ourselves, we'll get involved to put things right. These are moral emotions that we can be very celebrate as human beings. But it's those moral emotions that actually got really diminished by our culture that then told us we need to be selfish above all else.
I want to go back a little bit because I want to understand how a web of meaning gets created within a subculture. Conspiracy theorists and the whole QAnon How does such a huge alternative to what most people think and believe, how that gets created? How does that even come about? So we have, maybe as much as 30% of the U.S. living in an alternative view of what the world says is real. Do you know?
Yeah.
How does that happen?
Sure. Yeah, well, I think that has a lot to do, again, with what I describe as this human patterning instinct.
Mm-hmm.
We are driven instinctually, and this is part of what makes us unique as human beings, along with those moral emotions I talked about. We're driven to pattern meaning into the universe around us. And you can see that that's an instinct, because every time a baby is born, no one tells her, hey, you're meant to learn our language, but her instinct is to pattern meaning into the words she hears and the feelings that she feels around her, and then over time she uses that to learn a language, and then she uses it to learn the culture. So if we look at what's going on right now, we find that people have been they have been suffering from a loss of meaning, and that's a place that human beings simply cannot accommodate. They can't live with the loss of meaning. It's something that is deep in our instinct. And this loss of meaning has come about through a number of layers. I mean, one really has been through our consumer culture, which has dominated our lives now for over 100 years or more in this country in particular, which basically tells us, you know, the only meaning in life is to sort of have status and be as successful as possible. That's a big way in which our meaning got destroyed. And so people then learning that, they put their meaning into things like status, mm-hmm. things like their economic place in the world, and into their communities. Then, with this rise in neoliberalism for the last few decades, even those got taken away. Communities have been devastated. Economic stability has been totally blown away. And so, with lacking that sense of meaning, people will look anywhere for some other way to create a pattern of meaning that they can just get, that can give them a sense of comfort, because this is deep instinct that's needed so badly. So if somebody comes along and says, okay, here's a new meaning pattern for you, it doesn't matter really how rational it is. What matters is, does it touch that deep instinct people have to find a way of making sense of things? And if there's a way in which it can make sense of things in such a way that they also feel a deep connection with certain people around them, and they can feel somewhat vindicated, so if they have been losing out, and somebody tells them, here's the reason why, it's all because of those bad people over there, then they will get drawn into that false pattern of meaning. Because patterns of meaning don't necessarily have to be true. I mean, we've looked at, for the last two millennia, you know, we've been told in Western Europe, for example, that, you know, that God created the earth and God created the universe in 6 days, and there was Adam and Eve, and, you know, this whole story of the Bible. People absolutely believed that as fundamentally true for millennia. And it's only with the scientific revolution that people really started to ask different questions about the universe. So it's because people have such a need to find, to pattern some kind of meaning into their lives, that I think we find ourselves in this situation right now.
So I would kind of like to move from that to the Taoism, Buddhism discussion of that view of reality. I've done a bit of studying. My son teaches Buddhism, so I've done a little bit of studying in Buddhism, and it is a creation of your own universe. So how do we stick to reality, and what do Taoism and Buddhism add to our understanding of what we're doing in creating meaning?
Yeah, well, I think that one of the things that we need to see is that once we recognize that actually we have this worldview that tells us that we're all separate from each other, we're all selfish, and we think that that's scientific. And once we begin to recognize that actually that there are different ways to make sense of the world, then it makes sense to try to look at ways of making sense that might actually relate more to both what modern science tells us and what some of the great wisdom traditions have developed over many, many, many generations to help us to flourish in life. And so one of the things I explore in this book is when we look at how modern science has refuted this worldview of separation that is dominant, it's pointed a lot to connections between things. And we're talking about sciences like system sciences or complexity theory or evolutionary biology or cognitive science or network theory. These are all different sciences that show how deeply connected things are with each other. And then what's so fascinating is we find that some of the greatest insights from Taoism and Buddhism also talk about that same deep connectedness. They don't talk about it from the point of view, from a scientific standpoint. They didn't have this kind of modern science that we have now. But they pointed the way to some of the deep senses of interdependency that modern science also points to. For example, in Buddhism, there's this core concept that's known as dependent origination, mm-hmm. which basically says that everything that arises in our in the world, in the universe, arises not by itself, but as a result of its interconnection with all other things around it. And there's something that modern Buddhist teacher Thich Nhat Hanh mm-hmm. takes that mm-hmm. great concept and calls it into being. You know, he'll hold up a piece of paper and say, this paper has the sun and the clouds in it. And you'll say, well, what does that mean? He says, because, you know, the trees needed the sun and the rainfall from the clouds to create the bark that this paper came from. And if we look at that notion of connectedness, we see that there's profound, it shifts our notion of identity, of who we are, and also shifts our sense of ethics and morality. Like, what does it mean to be alive in this world?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do you see the same kinds of patterns and the same kinds of relationships in indigenous people? I mean, North American indigenous people or Australian indigenous people, that kind of connection to the land and the interdependence yeah. with the land and how...
That's right, yeah. How, no, exactly. What? So, I mean, something you see in indigenous traditions around the world, you know, they can be as far apart as the Inuit in the north, or Aboriginals in Australia, or Native Americans here in this continent, and they all have this deep sense of nature being like a family, basically, and the rest of non-human beings around us being like our relatives. So this is a really interesting concept because, of course, Western science for many centuries, you know, from the Scientific Revolution onwards, like, poo-pooed these things as if they're just this, oh, this kind of, you know, silly, primitive kind of understanding of the world. And what's so fascinating is that what modern biology now recognizes is that actually that is absolutely true. We are deeply related to every other living being on this earth. And scientists have traced all of life back to what they call a common ancestor, right, some billions of years ago. And what's so fascinating is that even if you look at something that seems so different from us that it seems like we could have nothing in relation to it, something like a banana, for example, it turns out that banana, roughly 44% of its genes, it shares with us as human beings. So this very deep layer, we are related to life, just like indigenous cultures have told us, you know, all around the world.
And so did science take us wrong? Was science the kind of beginning of how we started to go awry? Because it seems in the beginning we were trying to explore the larger world, but But then it took us a, it disconnected us in some ways from the world. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, well, I don't really believe it's science that led us wrong. And I'm not even sure, really, if wrong is the word. But I do think we've gotten unbalanced. And that's really, when I'd say to find our place in the universe, it's another way of saying it would be to, like, rebalance our place in the universe. But I think that what's... if we do look at where, how that imbalance began, it actually goes way before the beginning of science. There was really something in the Western worldview, which actually we can trace all the way back to the ancient Greeks, that saw humans as being fundamentally different from the rest of nature, and that actually saw this kind of split cosmos, that humans had a soul and a body, and it's like the soul was imprisoned in the body, and the idea of life really was to free the soul and sort of get back to some sort of sense of divinity that was outside of the earth. So some people, there's the word of desacralizing the earth, as if the earth is no longer sacred, but sacredness came from outside somewhere. And Christianity took these ideas and created these ideas of, you know, if you're a good person in life, your soul will go to heaven forever afterwards. Even all the way back to Apostle Paul, there was a sense of the soul and the body being in this battle to the death kind of thing. But what was interesting is that Christianity actually laid, it was like an incubator for science, because those early scientific, those brilliant pioneers like Galileo or Newton or Descartes, they all saw themselves actually as doing God's work, because they felt God gave us reason, and reason was what connected us with divinity. And so understanding how this kind of machine, this sort of incredibly intricate clockwork that God had made on the earth, understanding that was the best thing that humans could do, to use their reason in that way. So they very much saw themselves as basically sort of decoding God's book, if you will. And I don't think that led us wrong, in the sense that it's given us so many incredible benefits. And every time I talk about this in the book, I really try to emphasize how much we can be grateful to this way of thinking. And this is what is known as reductionism, not science in itself.
Okay, right.
There's a particular form of science called reductionism that breaks things apart and that has given us all the wonders of our technology that we have today. And this is the what's happened is that it's led to this imbalance where now we actually think that nature really is a machine. And so if we have things like climate breakdown, rather than saying, like, is our way of relating to nature somehow wrong at the deepest levels, we say, some people say, oh, well, it's a broken, you know, the earth is like a broken system. So we have to treat it as an engineering problem, and let's keep doing the system we have right now, but let's add, say, like, geoengineering to try to reflect some of those sun's, the sun's solar radiation back, so that we can keep doing what we're doing, rather than looking at the deeper layers of how we relating to the earth and how we might change those.
I wanted to throw in too that from our work, we're former teachers of rhetoric and composition, and did some work on the rhetoric of science, and people in our field are saying science is rhetorical. It's not reductionist. There are rhetorical choices to be made. And in fact, getting work published is a matter of rhetoric. And the choice of topics, the one that I enjoy is that many people confess that the topic of their doctoral dissertation comes from the fact that their advisor told them to do it. Or they could get funding from the National Institute of Health or somebody else. So it's not neutral probing this set universe. It's people making selections and then arguing the case for what they've figured out.
Well, I think that's true. And that comes back again to this notion of like how we look for patterns. So just like we were talking before about how people who reject science, you know, will live in this kind of totally, you know, made up, a dangerously sort of mythical world of conspiracy theories or whatever. But what's interesting is even within science, people can get very tribal, and they very much want to stick with a paradigm. So something that's really fascinating is that when you look at what I have described as reductionism, people have gotten so taken by this excessive reductionism that a lot of people have then made this gigantic leap of faith to say, reductionism explains so much about the world and has been so successful that it must explain everything about the universe, and there's no other way of explaining it other than by breaking things apart into little bits. And when they do that, and they say, well, the universe itself then is clearly meaningless. It's just a bunch of, you know, millions of trillions, innumerable billiard balls hitting each other, and that's all that there is in the universe. And that's what I call in the book ontological reductionism, which basically, ontological just means basically a belief about existence, if you will, or pertaining to existence. So it's saying that's where reductionism goes from being scientific to being a leap of faith. Every much as big a leap of faith in some ways as saying that God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh or whatever. Because there are other ways of looking at how our systems actually work. And what a lot of systems sciences do is they don't refute reductionism. They don't say, oh, actually, you know, there's some other dimension which and reductionism doesn't work in this other dimension. It accepts the materiality of everything in the universe, but it looks at the ways things connect up. And by looking at these principles of these connections and how they self-organize and how this process emerges, what's called emergence, where new layers of complexity arise from the way things actually connect up, that leads to a whole different understanding of our world around us that reductionism alone simply is unable to perceive.
How does the common man hook into these kinds of concepts? I mean, I think that Buddhism and traditional cultures had an understanding of the connectedness, but it came out of their culture, it came out of their experience, it came out of their traditions, and we've created a whole new way of valuing the world and of breaking things up and of leaning on or believing in material existence as a kind of be-all and end-all. So how do you transform a culture where the web of meaning is kind of warped?
Here's what I find the sort of good news about all that, is that each of us, by virtue of being born as a human being, have those deep desires for connection and the connections themselves deep within us, that actually our culture has to layer over what is intuitively what we feel is right. It has to tell us that it's wrong year after year after year until we kind of forget it. So you don't need to read a ton of books or even any books to reconnect with that meaning. All that you really need to do is go for a walk in nature. Feel into the awe, the magnificence, the incredible richness of what you see around you. All you need to do is look at a loved one and in the eyes, and the feelings that arise in you actually start to turn towards those feelings, embrace them, recognize them as being valid, and not believing that your only existence is your kind of reasoning brain, but actually begin to recognize yourself as what I call in the book like an integrated organism, an organism that has this thinking capacity like all humans. That make us very unique as humans, but also that has this beating heart, this sense of desire for connection, for warmth, and just all the different things that other animals around us and share with us, and recognize how deeply we share those deep feelings with all of life. Like if you walk in your backyard and you see, for example, there's been a drought, and you see the plants lacking water, and even though of course plants don't feel thirst the way you and I do, we can feel that sense that they're not happy, that there's something suffering for them, that they're struggling, because we know what it's like to be thirsty. And so that way of looking at those deep connections without becoming anthropomorphic, and without trying to interpret everything through the lens as if we're all, as if everything else is like human beings, we can go to those deep archetypal connections we have with all of life. And it's right there waiting in each of us to just be felt and to be part of our living existence.
I wanted to transition just a little bit. You do have a lot of science in the book. Could you characterize for us the kind of science that you were looking at? A lot of it neurological, not traditional nuts and bolts, invent the combustion engine kind of science.
Right.
What are the sources that interest you at the moment?
Yeah, well, one area I look at a lot is, as you just mentioned, is neuroscience. And one of the things that points us to discover is very much along the lines of what I was just describing. Ever since Descartes actually had made this famous statement in philosophy that says, "I think, therefore I am." Mm-hmm. Probably the most famous statement in Western philosophy. But ever since then, hundreds of years ago, we kind of think that our identity is just that thinking part of our brain, like somewhere in the sort of top of our brain. And even when we try to connect with our bodies, we think that I have a body, like as if I is this kind of soul or this separate entity. And something that cognitive neuroscience, has shown us now in recent decades is that actually we're very much embodied creatures. We have this deep intelligence in our nervous system, that we don't exist without our bodies, that our minds and themselves arise from how we interact with all of the neurons and all the feelings and hormones and everything and our emotions around us, and also how we enact and how we relate to the rest of the world around us, that everything is very much deeply interconnected. So that's, for example, one of the findings that we see in neuroscience. Or another area I look at a lot is biology, and especially evolutionary biology. Mm-hmm. And one of the incredible findings that evolutionary biology now shows us is rather than evolution being all about selfishness and competitiveness, and you know, we're told that ever since Dawkins wrote The Selfish Gene in the 1970s, mm-hmm. it's become so popularized that we think that evolution is just the result of competing genes out-competing each other. Well, it turns out that if you look back all the way from the single tiniest protocell on Earth billions of years ago, the great steps in evolution all came about through different entities, different species and organisms, learning how to cooperate better with each other. And that it was through finding these deep places of cooperating where each different organism brought its specific skills to create a whole that was greater than the sum of its parts, that it was rises in cooperation that actually have caused all the amazing rich abundance of life and nature that we see around us today.
Do you think there are universal human and maybe animal values that have emerged through this cooperation? We think of the golden rule as universal.
A great question. Well, that's one of the things I actually explore in the book. I mean, we tend to think of values. I guess for starters, most people think of values as like whatever their values are, those are just the right ones. They're just essentially right. But when people do try to analyze values more, what we see in different cultures and different ways of thinking, it seems to be almost like there can be almost in any way of creating a value system, because we see so many different ones around. But if we do look at our deep connection with all of life around us, and we start to look to your question, is there some sort of shared value that all of life shares? It turns out that there is. There's really like a deep purpose of life, which in simple terms is simply to create more of life. And that sounds kind of, well, isn't mm-hmm. that kind of obvious, or is that too too simplistic or whatever? But if you actually look at how life actually arose on Earth billions of years ago, what we see is that it did something really quite like just almost miraculous that maybe it's been done elsewhere in the universe, but we certainly don't know about that right now. But the universe as a whole, what science tells us, is undergoing a process of what's called entropy. And there's a law in physics called the second law of thermodynamics, which basically says that there's this irrevocable, inevitable move from organization to disorganization, so that ultimately the universe is going to suffer this heat death many, many billions of years into the future, because everything gets more and more disorganized. And we see entropy in our daily life. As you sort of, if you take cream and put it in your coffee, you can't separate the cream again once it's mixed. Or if you break an egg for an omelet, you're never going to be able to put the egg back into have a separate yolk again. That's a sense of the way things kind of fall apart, if you will. But what life did is it actually learned to take that entropy and take the matter and energy and organize it inside its own little membrane in a way that actually created essentially a temporary reversal of entropy, almost like a rebellion against the second law of thermodynamics. Mm. And that's what life has done for the last almost four billion years on this Earth, is it's maintained this ongoing reversal of entropy, a local reversal of entropy on this Earth. And that's a glorious thing that life's done. And as humans, we can see ourselves, actually, each one of us, is really just one part of this unfolding miracle, if you will, that life has been creating on this Earth for billions of years.
So where do we go from here? That's kind of what's been kind of bugging me, this paradigm shift that we need to create that awareness that you described about going into the garden or seeing what your plants or the birds are doing. But that's not where our culture is. We need a paradigm shift in our culture that brings that awareness.
Greater
to bring
organization,
that
perhaps, yes.
We do. And, I mean, there's no doubt about it. And this is also something I explore in this book in some detail, is our dominant culture is really actually is leading us to just destroy that richness and abundance of Earth at a faster and faster pace. And we're not just talking about climate breakdown, which is itself terrifying, but this ecological devastation that's going on. We've actually now set in motion the sixth great extinction of species since life began on Earth. And the other ones are caused by things like volcanoes erupting or asteroids hitting the Earth. This one's actually caused by this one species, humankind. But not just by this one species, but by this core operating system of global capitalism that is designed to really try to turn the Earth into the financial resources as fast and rapidly as possible, and is doing something similar to us as humans. It's really designed to actually turn each of us as human beings to take us away from that sense of deep connection and really turn us into consumer zombies, essentially. Just train us to work as hard as possible to be cogs in the system to help to destroy the sort of quality of the Earth as fast as possible. And it's doing that, and it's doing it at a faster and faster rate. And I think anyone who really does open to these things does feel a sense of sort of terror at what's going on, and certainly has to feel some level of despair almost when we see what's happening.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so I describe this a lot in, and I explore this a lot in the final chapter of the book. And certainly I speak, I can say for myself, there's many times I felt that sense of teetering on a sense of despair, because it seems like we're moving so fast in the wrong direction. But one of the ways in which we don't necessarily have to sort of live in that place of despair is this recognition that the way life works and the way society and civilization and culture works is fundamentally nonlinear. The things that seem impossible to change can oftentimes surprise everyone and change in dramatic fashions when we expect it the least. And what we have going for us, and the reason I do, and to me the greatest source of hope, is that none of us as human beings want this destruction. As I said before, we're born into a species, as we grow up, that wants to be connected. We actually want to be part of groups. We actually want to feel a sense of flourishing and a sense of beauty and natural beauty around us and be part of a flourishing earth. And nobody actually wants to feel that they're leaving a destroyed, horrendous nightmare for future generations. We want to feel we're doing good for our future. So what that means is that we kind of have humanity on our side, and we have life on our side. And it's not that there's a group of bad people out there who are trying to destroy the world, but it's rather these self-organized systems, these self-reinforcing systems, have gotten to be so powerful that they kind of suck people into that system. And so if enough of us can actually connect up and share our power of connection with each other, we have the potential to change things. And there are signs all around the world of some of those changes happening. There are signs all around the world of people feeling that greater sense of connectedness. There are signs, you know, when the coronavirus first hit a year and a half ago, and it seemed like countries weren't responding appropriately and governments weren't, people immediately went to community care and self-care and worked together to help each other, because that's who we are as human beings.
I love the optimism. We have like about a half a minute here, literally. Could you tell us about your work with the, in a half a minute, the Leology Institute? What is Lee? What are you doing with the Leology Institute?
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, basically, Lee is just actually a word coming from those Neo-Confucian sages from 1,000 years ago that refers to the organizing principles that connect everything together. So the Leology Institute, the word Leology, just refers to really the study, the embodied study and practice of recognizing our deep interconnectedness with all things.
Oh, good. And so what are you trying to do with it? Just teach people that?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Use not just ideas and teachings, but more like embodied practices and community workshops together, and even things like music and all different modalities to recognize that actually we live in this integrated world together, and we can develop practices from some of the best things in Buddhism, Taoism, and scientific understanding to really live that more meaningful and embodied life.
And listeners, you can go to, there's a website, www.leology.org. Check it out for news about those workshops and the broader principles behind Leology. Our guest tonight on Ecotopia has been Jeremy Lent. He's author of a recently released book from New Society Publishers, one of our favorite publishers. It's called The Web of Meaning, Integrating Science and Traditional Wisdom to Find Our Place in the Universe. It's a very rich book. We can't have begun to do it justice in this interview. That's why it's a book rather than just a one-hour interview. But read the book, listeners, and thank you, Jeremy Lent, for being with us tonight.
Thank you. Great to speak with you, Stephen and Susan. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. Coming up in a few minutes, it's North State Give and Take with Bobby Tryon. She'll be conducting an interview tonight with Chico Vilo. She'll be talking specifically with John Pearson. We also want to tell you that on Thursday, August 12th, Gail Kimball, Dr. Gail, on her program, 6 to 7 on Thursdays on KZFR, she'll be talking with local historian Michelle Shover. They'll discuss 19th century Chico history, in particularly discrimination against Chinese and Machupto workers. And then in another month, Gail is only on once a month, unfortunately. And on September 9th, she'll be talking about with people who run Chico family businesses. But at any time, you can go on Gail Kimball's YouTube channel. She has many videos available that go into that have developed as a result of her work, not only on KZFR, but her work as a writer. So, North State Give and Take coming up in just a little bit. And then at 6:30, it's Ginger Nichols with Radioactive.
You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. Please be sure to visit our website for notes and recordings of recent programs, plus an ever-growing list of resources provided by our guests. The web address is ecotopiakzfr.com. We also welcome your comments and suggestions. Send us an email at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com.
I also want to give a forward promotion. Next week, we'll be talking with David Ballier. He's written a book called Free, Fair, and Alone. It meshes very nicely with what Jeremy Lent discussed. David approaches his philosophy from the point of view of the commons, commonly owned resources, and he argues that the concept of the commons can help to get us out of the current kind of mess that we were discussing with Jeremy. His book, as we'll say next week, is kind of a blockbuster, as is Jeremy Lent's. Two great books, both from New Society publishers, both well worth reading. Thank you for listening to Ecotopia.
You are the new day. If you can but prove to me you are the new day, send us on in time for dawn. Let the buds all hail the morning. Love of life will urge me say, you are. Knowing we must end, thoughts occur that this night might stay yesterday. Thoughts that we as humans mourn could slow words and end it all. Lie
up next is North State Give and Take. And North State Give and Take is made possible by generous contributions of KZFR supporters, that's you, and by the Cotton Party, offering contemporary women's clothing and accessories with an emphasis on natural fibers in the heart of downtown Chico. Cotton Party's been providing friendly service for over 30 years at 337 Broadway Street. Cotton Party is grateful for your business and offers complimentary gift wrapping with each purchase. More information by calling the Cotton Party at 893-4923 and by the Printed Image, providing screen printing and embroidery in Chico since 1980. The Printed Image, open Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. and by appointment. More information by calling 530-898-9525. Welcome to North State Give and Take. I'm Bobby Tryon. Today I am welcoming John Pearson from, you just call it Velo?
Yes. Well, so, you know, Chico Velo has been around for around 40 years. The Wildflower for sure has been 40 years, and some version of
the organization has been around kind of that long. So I think at this point, Velo is kind of the common vernacular of what we are. You know, we started out years ago as just a writing club. It started as Mellow Velo, and, you know, Ed and a few other people, and just getting together, hanging out, riding bikes,